The following content is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, enjoy articles to help you improve your green thumb. And now, here's NCRS volunteer Cindy Fowler.
We'll start with the Raleigh News and Observer. This article by Nancy Brakey. Spring tasks await. Let's get going. Thanks to wet, chilly days recently, some gardening tasks normally finished by now remain undone. Fortunately, longer days and better weather will give us all a chance to catch up and get ahead as spring unfolds in all its glory. The next month, however, is critical for certain tasks. Perhaps you have noticed that some perennials, such as clumps of chrysanthemums, daylilies, and Shasta daisies, already show signs of fresh growth. This is a truly cheerful sight, and the plants should benefit from an application of garden fertilizer. Most perennials are best dug and divided after flowering, but if yours seem especially crowded, consider dividing and replanting them now. Take care to water them regularly as the small plants develop new roots and shoots. What fun that is to watch! Look, too, for seedlings of Lenten roses that have sprouted, grown nicely, and are ready for transplanting to a permanent spot. Vegetables, too, deserve your time, space, and effort. Young plants of leaf lettuce, broccoli, cauliflower, and cabbage are in garden centers, ready for planting. These vegetables grow beautifully in the cool days of early spring and will reward you with good food. You must not fret that they will get overchilled because all are quite hardy. This is also a way to get your garden working before tomato time arrives in late April. And who can stifle their eagerness for that moment? And certainly, this is planting time for roses and azaleas. Garden centers offer roses in pots that make it easy to transplant without disturbing the roots. Some are sold in plastic bags, their roots wrapped in damp moss. Azaleas are coming into bloom, and some gardeners want to see the color of the flowers before they buy plants. Woody plants, such as shrubs and roses planted now, will require close attention to watering during the hot, dry weeks that will surely come this summer. Other plants, whether young or established, will benefit from fertilizer applied now, just as the growing season begins. This is a nice task for twilight time. Just rake back the mulch. Then, following the guidelines for amount stated on the fertilizer package label, sprinkle the product over the root zone. If you are fertilizing a large plant, sprinkle the fertilizer just below the outer edge of the shrub's canopy. This is where most of the feeder roots are growing. Pansies that have grown all winter in a flower bed or container will benefit now from removal of spent blooms, a process called deadheading. A light application of fertilizer formulated for flowers will also help them rev up for a good season of new bloom through the spring. They have many weeks of good bloom ahead before it is time to replace them with summer flowers. Now for some Ask Nancy. Question. What should I do about the paper white narcissus that have been in a pot since they bloomed at Christmas? The foliage is turning yellow. Answer. If you have a spot outdoors, such as a flower bed, lift the bulbs out of the pot, shake off the soil, cut off the yellow foliage, and plant them so that the tips of the bulbs are about 2 inches below the soil level. Another question. I see tiny flowers that are white, sort of star-shaped, in grass around town. What is this? Answer. Those are spring star flowers, a lovely little plant that grows from bulbs planted in the fall. It is remarkably resilient and is always a delight to see when the flowers appear in March. And now from the state-by-state gardening e-newsletter. Color eggs with natural dyes from the garden by Cindy Shapton. Brightly colored eggs were often given as gifts by the ancient Greeks, Persians, and Chinese at their annual spring celebrations. Early Christians gave decorated and dyed eggs as a symbol of Jesus' resurrection as early as the Middle Ages to friends, family, and servants on Easter Sunday. Our German ancestors then brought this tradition of coloring Easter eggs to America, and interestingly, it did not really take off until after the Civil War. Folks in those days could not go to the department store and buy egg coloring kits. So, what did they use to dye their eggs? Flowers, leaves, and fruits of plants growing nearby or in their gardens. Many of the plant materials used as dyes often were cool season crops that were ready about the same time as Easter. Beets, cabbage, carrots, kale, onions, and spinach were some of the vegetables chopped and simmered for dyes. Herbs and seasonings that had been dried were steeped into teas, or canned fruits and vegetables from the pantry were available if needed. Like the petrochemical dye kits, this can get messy and it will stain clothes, countertops, floors, pets, and whatever else it comes in contact with, so plan accordingly. There are three basic processes using natural plant materials to color eggs. 1. A hot process where plant material and eggs are boiled together. 2. A cold process where plant material and eggs are prepared separately. Or 3. Eggs soaked in herb tea. For the hot method, place a single layer of white eggs in a non-aluminum pan covered with cold, filtered water. Add a splash of white vinegar, about a tablespoon, to set the dye. Add plant material to produce the color you wish. Bring to a boil, reduce heat, and simmer 10 to 15 minutes. Check the color periodically. When the color's good, pour off the hot liquid and rinse the eggs until they're cool and store in the refrigerator. If you want a deeper color, strain the hot liquid through a coffee filter and cool while you are rinsing the eggs. Then place the boiled eggs in a glass bowl and cover with the strained, cooled dye liquid and place in the refrigerator until the desired shade is achieved, less than a day or overnight. More than 12 hours only make the colors muddy looking. For a mottled look, wrap your uncooked eggs with leaves or onion skins, followed by a piece of cotton muslin. Gather and tie up tightly with some cotton string. Cover the wrapped eggs with water, bring to a boil, reduce heat, and simmer 10 to 15 minutes. Drain and rinse with cool water before unwrapping. For the cool-dipped method, place the natural plant material, about 4 cups, or spices, 3 tablespoons, in about a quart of filtered water. Add 1 to 2 tablespoons of white vinegar and simmer about 30 minutes. Cool to room temperature and strain into glass bowls. Place cooled boiled eggs in this dye for about 30 minutes. For a darker hue, place in the refrigerator overnight. And herb tea can be used to dye eggs. Simply pour boiling water over herbs in a covered non-aluminum pan, quart jar, or a teapot. Steep 10 to 15 minutes, and then place the cooled boiled eggs in the tea and soak 30 minutes. For darker hues, continue soaking the eggs in tea overnight in the refrigerator. Use 1 to 3 teaspoons of dried herbs for each cup of boiling water. Use 3 times the amount if the herbs are fresh. For darker shades, add a little more. Added vinegar is not necessary for herbs. If you plan to eat your naturally dyed eggs, be diligent to refrigerate after the coloring process is complete. To make dyed eggs that can be used for several years, poke a hole in both ends of fresh eggs with a pin or small nail. Blow the yolks and whites out into a bowl. Quiche fish fixings. Be sure to pierce the yolks so it is easier to blow out without passing out. These beautiful eggs can be displayed by hanging from branches or wreaths on the front door. Write down what dye or combination works well. You think you will remember next year, but just in case, make a note. Try brown eggs, too. I love the different shades they produce. Make this the year you go green and start a new tradition of dyeing Easter eggs the natural way, just like great-great-grandmother did, using materials from the kitchen and garden. And now from the Triangle Gardener, Malabar spinach, easy, edible, and elegant. As a young Peace Corps volunteer in Africa, I ate many cooked leaves and other things that I had never seen before. This article is by Gina Myers. One that stood out for its vigor and beauty was a vine we called Malabar spinach. When I returned home, I was thrilled to find this jack-in-the-beanstalk-sized vine grew fine here, but as an annual rather than a perennial. If you love to grow unique plants and try new foods, this can be quite the edible conversation piece in your summer garden. Although known by many names, such as Ceylon, C-E-Y-L-O-N, red vine, buffalo, and climbing spinach, Malabar spinach is not actually in the spinach family. There are 2 common species, one with brilliant red stems and leaf veins, and one with green leaves and white stems. Both originate from tropical Asia. So here, in our brutal hot summers, Malabar spinach absolutely thrives. It prefers full or partial sun with moist, well-drained soil, but will not fall apart if it gets dry. It is very frost-sensitive, so I do try to pull it out before frost hits, as it turns into slippery mush when frozen. You can purchase seeds and start them indoors 6 to 8 weeks before the last frost, as it starts slow and won't take off until it's very warm. After the first year, this prolific seeder will usually produce just a few seedlings that you can move to wherever you want. Even if lots of seedlings show up, they are easy to pull and not a problem. I haven't had to purchase seeds in years. You can also root cuttings easily in water if you want to share with a friend. Once Malabar spinach starts growing, you better have a fence or a sturdy trellis to support its lusciousness. It can grow 30 feet with lots of branches if it has plenty of water and good soil. I often grow it along the fence of my compost pile to hide the garden debris inside. It completely covers the outside by midsummer. It can be left to grow on the ground, but it stays cleaner and more attractive as a climbing vine. Plus, you get to enjoy the sweet pink or white flowers that grow on short spikes along the thick stems. These turn into deep purple berries for the birds or for making beautiful food coloring. Malabar spinach is easy to grow, generally insect and disease-free, and a lovely, vigorous vine. But how about the taste? Most agree that the glossy new leaves and stems are the best ones to eat fresh, as they are tender and have a lemon or peppery flavor. The larger, bigger than your hand, leaves develop a mucilaginous texture, somewhat like okra, especially when overcooked. This can be useful to thicken soups and stews, but may not please your dinner guests unless they are okra fans. Younger leaves are also excellent in stir-fry, boiled, or sautéed with garlic and other condiments. Asian recipes can provide ideas on how to utilize this super garden performer. And even if the flavor is not your favorite vegetable in the garden, it's a bounteous plant that brings the tropics to your summer garden. This article by Nancy Brakey. Saucer magnolia tree, a lovely early bloomer. Blooms really popped out in the past few days, brightening the scene with lovely spring colors that stand out against the late winter landscape. I think one of the best of these early bloomers is the saucer magnolia, a medium-sized tree that unfolded its blooms almost overnight. This is such a joy to see, not forgetting the bridal wreath spireas, forsythias, star magnolias, daffodils, redbuds, and camellias that also make this a beautiful time of year. And the saucer magnolia brings not only beautiful flowers, but a lovely tree well-suited for smaller properties, typically growing at a moderate pace over time to 15 to 25 feet tall and wide. It typically has several trunks, which makes it seem like a large shrub for many years, until it matures into a taller plant that is clearly a tree. It is, of course, a relative of the evergreen southern magnolia, famed for its beautiful white blooms in late spring, and one of the symbols of gardening in the South. Another relative is the pretty star magnolia, a shrub or small tree with frilly petals on its early blooms. The plant prospers in acidic soil, enhanced with organic matter, such as compost, and will grow in part shade to full sun. As with most trees and shrubs, it prefers well-drained soil with even moisture through the year. As it is deciduous, meaning the leaves drop in autumn, but the silhouette left behind is striking because of the branching habit that begins low on the trunks, spreading horizontally in a graceful manner. The flowers, depending on the variety, may be pink, white, purple, or burgundy, but most of what we see are all pink or pink and white. Their shape leads some people to name it tulip magnolia. Though remarkably carefree, the early blooms of saucer magnolias, typically 3 to 5 inches in diameter, may be harmed by a sudden deep freeze in early March. That has happened to a few times to my saucer, a variety named Alexandrina, which has been growing for more than 35 years. There is, of course, no way to cover a big plant as you would a hydrangea facing a deep freeze in April. But it is a risk worth taking, doesn't happen too often, and should not discourage you from choosing this great plant. Some of the newer hybrids bloom a bit later and should accept such freezes. And now for Ask Nancy. Question. I want a dramatic but small plant for my desk. Some things I see are rather blah. Any ideas? Answer. Though it is a philodendron, Prince of Orange is far from ordinary. The new foliage is a beautiful orange, which contrasts nicely with the older, deep green foliage. Give it bright, indirect light. Water it about once a week, allowing the soil to dry out a bit between watering. Should the leaves turn pale, move to a less bright location. And next, from the State-by-State Gardening e-newsletter, Starting Veggies Indoors by Rita Randolph. Spring is around the corner, and even though I caution folks about planting and seeding too early in the season, truthfully, it's safe to go ahead and start a few things indoors. Choose the varieties recommended for your area and read how long it takes to produce each crop. Some may not take as long as others. For instance, lettuces can be directly sown into containers and grow quickly in cooler temperatures, yet tomatoes benefit from seeding in one container at a warm temperature and then transplanted to a larger container to grow a better root system before being put into the ground. Squash, cucumbers, and melons are faster crops and like to be sown closer to planting time. Sow multiple seed directly into 3 or 4 inch pots, and once developed, directly plant them into the garden. Reputable seed companies all offer specific information about each type of vegetable or plant they offer. Some offer better information than others, and I depend on these as a guide. Check the varieties for how large they grow. For instance, determinate bush tomatoes do not take as much room as indeterminate vine varieties. Store your seed tightly closed in a refrigerator, not a freezer, when not in use. Many varieties last for years if stored properly. To garden indoors or start your plants inside, the first thing to do is dedicate an area for this purpose. Find a south-facing window because it provides the most light for ensuring healthy starts. If not a south window, select the brightest one you have. You can always move plants away if it becomes too hot to handle. You need a sturdy table for seeding and related equipment. Cover it with plastic so moisture won't ruin the surface. Then set up a stand with a fluorescent light fixture or two for your plants after they begin to grow. There are grow lights of all kinds, but fluorescents are cool lights and still provide the wide spectrum necessary to keep seedlings and other plants from stretching. You needn't turn on the lights yet. Wait until after the seeds germinate. A leggy plant is not a healthy one, and you might as well purchase new plants or start over if stretching becomes a problem. Next, you need a heat source under the trays for the root systems to develop. Heating mats for this purpose are available in all sizes and prices. It's a good investment if you keep your home or growing area cool. The rooting zone of most vegetable and annual seedlings should be 68 to 78 degrees Fahrenheit, and uniform heating is best. Begin with a tray that acts as a capturing device for water and does not drain indoors. You can remove excess water with a sponge if it builds up. This will prevent spills on the floor and furniture and may help keep humidity levels up in the growing area. Place a capillary mat in the tray you plan to set your seeded pots in. A capillary mat is a spongy fiber about a quarter inch thick. When you water your pots, this mat will wick away excess moisture from some containers while providing it for others. It makes watering more uniform through the system, keeping plants moist but not wet. Seed that's germinating do not like to stay constantly wet. After sowing seeds in trays, place them on the capillary mat inside the tray that does not have holes. Then water in well with a sprayer or spray bottle. A light spray is best. Be sure to wet the capillary mat too, but not soak it to the point of water pooling. Sow seeds thinly in your pots. Overcrowding will result in stretched, unhealthy seedlings. The more room you give them, the better your plants will turn out. Cover seeds only as deep as the seed is in diameter. Small seeds only need a dusting of mix. Be careful not to bury your seeds, or they may not come up at all. Label your seed as you sow with a waterproof pin. After seeding and watering them in, cover the tray with another tray, preferably black or dark in color, balancing it on top of the other like a lid. The tray will hold in humidity and shut out light, as well as keep the warmth in from your heating mat. I usually cover the seeded trays with a sheet of plastic to chamber the trays. Check your seeds a couple of times a day for moisture, being careful not to let them dry out or remain too wet. Remove the lids on the trays as soon as the first two leaves appear. As soon as most seeds have germinated, turn on the lights. Keep the lights a foot or two away from the young plants so they don't dry out too quickly. As the plants mature, you might want to lower the fixture a little closer. Check frequently for drying out or wilting too much. Try not to water in the evening hours, since wet foliage overnight is a disease waiting to happen. This extra light not only helps keep plants short and healthy, but also helps to prevent many waterborne diseases and stem rot. When young seedlings are an inch or two tall, it's time to decide if they will be planted out into the ground, transplanted into larger pots, or hardened off for later. Reducing the average temperatures, withholding some water, and yet still maintaining high light conditions will accomplish this hardening. You can do this indoors or take them outside on good days, placing them in a partial shade location so they don't sunburn. Be sure to bring them back indoors on chilly nights below 57 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's all the time we have for today. You've been listening to Out in the Garden on the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast by visiting our website at ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, give us a call. Our telephone number is 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.